By the winter of 1986, a poison was loose in the spirit of the Soviet Union, and Gorbachev and his inner circle knew it. Their problem was that every year since the invasion, things had gotten worse, and now, after the Varenikov offensive, they were faced with the disturbing signs that the resistance, instead of being crushed, was showing new signs of vitality and lethal ability. In Afghanistan, the Soviets were, ironically, beginning to do themselves in with their own propaganda about how evil the Mujahideen were. The idea had not been to frighten their own troops, but that's what was happening with their warnings not to wander forth alone at night, not to walk into a store in Kabul without fellow soldiers as protection. There were frightening posters and official briefings from the moment the soldiers got off the transport planes at Bagram Air Base, whispers about what had happened to their colleagues. They all knew about the fanatic Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's practice of leaving armless and legless Soviet soldiers on the road. He wanted fresh troops to fly into a rage at the sight of their countrymen, twisting in a bloody pool, and come looking for revenge, right into his trap. They came to fear the sting in the back as a friendly shopkeeper talked to them, smiling, while an Afghan stuck them with a long pin with poison on its end to foul their lungs. Every Afghan now was the enemy. There was no such thing as a reliable Afghan ally. The Kipling poem about the fate of the British who had come here began to haunt the Red Army. When you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains, and go to your God like a soldier. According to the Russian journalist Artyom Borovik, writing later of what he saw in those days, the average Red Army soldier was now finding religion. The atheists were seeking God. They all seemed to be carrying an extra bullet to shoot themselves if captured. They were filled with superstitions. Many were becoming drug addicts, and the Afghans were selling them the dope, strong dope. Borovik describes them sitting around camp stoned, listening to Pink Floyd, and being terrorized by stories of the enemy waiting around every bend. If only they had an enemy they could fight in one all-out battle and have it be over with. But it was the endlessness and the shapelessness of it all. It was like being chased by some huge formless blob. Even when Afghan soldiers were captured and the Soviets resorted to torture, they were horrified to find that they couldn't get a reaction. The Afghans' eyes just stared out blankly. Gorbachev was trapped. The United States was escalating, and for the first time America looked as if it were prepared to stay the course. It was no longer clear that the Soviets could afford to pay the price of this war. It might take 500,000 soldiers or more to deal with this worsening situation. But that would force Gorbachev to go before the nation to admit that there had been a war in the first place and that the Red Army was losing. That was impossible. That February, Gorbachev acknowledged that Afghanistan had become a running sore in the side of the Soviet Union. No one at the Kremlin knew that several months after that speech, a U.S. Air Force plane landed in the dead of night at the same military airfield in Rawalpindi that the McCollum flights used. The CIA station chief was on hand to watch over the first shipment of Stingers. Brigadier Raza of the ISI was there as well, to make sure the special cargo was safely transported to the nearby facility, where a group of hand-picked holy warriors was waiting to begin its 8-week training course. Almost everything was starting to go in the wrong direction for the Soviets. In April, as the new fighting season reopened in Afghanistan, General Varenikov was suddenly pulled out of Kabul for an urgent mission of the highest national priority. The biggest nuclear accident in history had spread from the nuclear reactor at Chernobyl, poisoning thousands of square miles. After dispatching Varenikov, Gorbachev went underground and acted as if nothing had happened, until 11 days later, and then only after an international outcry. Some 200,000 wretched citizens were evacuated and conscript workers sent in to try to clean up the disaster. Instead of deploying a division to the border of Pakistan, Varenikov was now ordering suicide teams into the reactor chambers to clear out the deadly wastes. The world stood by horrified. At the White House, Reagan told his advisors that if Chernobyl had happened in America, it would have forced an end to his defense buildup. Gorbachev will feel it too, he said. Gorbachev was already feeling terrible pressures from all sides. The Soviet economy was on the verge of collapse. It couldn't afford the expense of keeping up with Reagan's menacing nuclear and conventional arms race. The Star Wars challenge had spooked the military establishment. Chernobyl couldn't possibly have come at a worse time. Varenikov had been incensed that month to discover that Reagan had just sent a guided missile, a smart bomb, into Gaddafi's tent. It was a humiliating, taunting move. Varenikov, the great strategist of the empire, felt the Soviets couldn't ignore such challenges, but he was also convinced that his own colleagues on the general staff, led by Defense Minister Yazov, had virtually bankrupted the country. As he saw it, they had fallen into a U.S. trap of building totally unnecessary weapons systems that the country couldn't afford just because the United States was building them. But the issue of how this crisis had come about was irrelevant. The bottom line for Gorbachev was that the center could not hold much longer. And so that spring in the Kremlin, historic internal debates began. Afghanistan was very much on the agenda. It was emblematic of the problems the Soviet system faced. A totalitarian state like the Soviet Union, a country with the greatest land mass in the world, must control its diverse population by force. But there's only so much an army or a police force can do. Ultimately, control lies on the perception that the government is all-powerful, instantly willing to crush any rebellion with cruel efficiency. In 1986 in Afghanistan, however, the Soviet might was ineffective. The Soviet leaders were forced to think the unthinkable. They had all but given up hope of breaking the resistance. Zia had stalled the UN talks in Geneva to give the CIA an extra month to rush in supplies. Once the accord was signed, both superpowers would be prohibited from any further arms shipments. Zia wanted to make sure that his and the CIA's Afghans were in a position to do in the Russian-Afghan surrogates. But that morning, the Mujahideen's secret stash at Ogiri was wiped out. 30,000 rockets, millions of rounds of ammunition, vast numbers of mines, Stingers, SA-7s, blowpipes, Milan anti-tank missiles, multiple-barrel rocket launchers, mortars. And they were not just exploding, they were killing Pakistanis. Over 100 people died, and more than 1,000 were wounded. That morning, as the rockets were still flying, the Pakistan dictator called his Washington ambassador, Jamshid Markar, with terse instructions. Get Judge Webster, Casey's successor at the CIA, and Charlie and tell them for God's sake to replace everything. Markar was amazed at his president's iron nerves. He didn't ask for help to put out the fires or to tend to the wounded. He just wanted one thing. He wanted more missiles. It was a stunning performance from a man who just a few months before had been on the edge of losing all U.S. assistance. Now, with his capital in flames, he was calling on the CIA director to rush another $100 million worth of the most sophisticated weaponry. He told Markar that it was essential for the Russians to know that the United States was doing this so that the Kremlin would not dare break the Geneva Accords. This was to be the last time that Zia called on the CIA and Charlie for help, and by all accounts it was one of the agency's all-time great logistics triumphs. Within 24 hours, huge U.S. cargo planes were unloading Stingers and other weapons taken directly from the frontline stores of NATO. Charlie had called Mohammed that same day to tell him the agency desperately needed mortars. Send the plane, replied Abu Razala, who then ordered the mortars to be taken from his frontline troops. In Islamabad, where the explosions continued intermittently for 2 days, Milt Bearden assumed the role of field commander. Bearden was now in his true element. This war had become so much fun that for a man like Bearden, there was a downside to it ending so fast. There were so many new weapons and gadgets to test out under real conditions. For example, they still hadn't tried out the Texas chainsaw, the fiber-optic wire-guided drone that a mujahid could fly right into the window of an IL-76 to blow up $100 million worth of Scuds. And everyone was dying to see how the latest version of the Israeli Charlie horse, a far cry from the original anti-aircraft cannon, would perform. This later weapon was designed to hurl hundreds of anti-personnel devices over a huge area, some floating down by parachute, all exploding at different altitudes with frightening impact. But Bearden had not been sent to Islamabad to enjoy himself. He was a pro, and the whole idea was to bring this war to a close. Bearden now decided that the best way to encourage the Soviet retreat was to take the covert war public. For Bearden, the game became not just replacing lost weapons, but sticking the knife into the Soviets and twisting it. Make them feel that the Ogiri arms depot explosion hadn't hurt a whit. So when the embassy initially protested the dispatch of resupply planes on the grounds that they would be identified, Bearden shouted them down.
Paint the planes in fluorescent paint. Put on the lights.
At an embassy reception just after the explosion, the station chief, dressed in a dark business suit, spotted his KGB counterpart and invited him into the garden. Overhead, the sky was filled with American C-141s and C-5s in holding patterns waiting to land.
Do you know what that is? Bearden asked, looking up at the agency's air bridge. It's a beautiful sight, isn't it?
His message was clear.